Satchmo at the Waldorf is a new one-man play by Terry Teachout. It runs at Shakespeare and Company's Tina Packer Playhouse through September 16th. The play takes us to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in March of 1971 as jazz great Louis Armstrong prepares for what will be his last performance. The production is directed by Gordon Edelstein. The award-winning artistic director of the Long Wharf Theater and stars Obie award-winning actor John Douglas Thompson. We are joined now by Terry Teachout and John Douglas Thompson. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So, Terry, let us begin with you. How did this production come to be?
That's a long, long story. This is my
okay.
first. This
well, we
is
have
my first
20 minutes,
play.
So
I'll keep it short. I'll give you the short version.
Whatever you.
I wrote a biography of Armstrong in 2009, and somebody wrote a note to my blog and said, "Hey, why don't you turn it into a play?" I'd never written a play, but I thought, "Okay, I'm game." So I wrote Satchmo at the Waldorf, and 2 years later, here we are.
What was it about that? About being at the Waldorf, of that being the last concert, of wanting to put it into that moment?
Well, a play is about a moment. It's about an event. And somebody's last gig is, by definition, a very dramatic point in their life. This is a one-man play, but it's also a multiple-character play. John is playing both Armstrong and Armstrong's manager. And at the very end of Armstrong's life, he had come to the conclusion that Joe Glazer, his manager, who had died a year or two before, had betrayed him. So I thought it would be interesting to have this snapshot of the climactic moment of Armstrong's professional life. And backstage, he's thinking back over that life and saying, what happened? Did this man that I trust, what came between us? And that was the seed from which the play grew.
For you, John, what is it like? I mean, you're a long time, you're a regular at Shakespeare and Company. You've been in many productions there. What is it like to do something like this of someone who's so iconic?
It's actually quite wonderful. I mean, most of the stuff I've done at Shakespeare and Company has been primarily... Oh, okay, here's the mic.
Yeah, that's okay.
I can hear
He's an
myself
actor.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't need a mic. I just use my voice.
Just project.
Just project in this sound booth. it was quite exciting because most of the stuff, as I said previously, that I've done at Shakespeare and Company has been of a classical range. Shakespeare, primarily, you know, I did Othello and Richard III and some other plays there. But I got to say, you know, looking at Armstrong's life and looking at it through the prism of this play, it is indeed Shakespearean. It is indeed Greek, if you will. And what's fascinating for me is to, on a nightly basis, try to capture the essence of this man through Terry's words. And what's great about the play is you're dealing with this iconic figure that everyone's aware of, a very beloved character, beloved person, who trades in goodwill, you know, back and forth, and getting to bring his essence out, given the choices he made in his life, looking back on his legacy and the consequences, a man dealing with the consequences of those life choices as an event that the play is quite wonderful. And then the other thing is I get to play Glazer and Armstrong and surprise Miles Davis. So for an actor, it's quite a workout and quite theatrical and quite a challenge. So for me, each night is, you know, on a level kind of pure bliss, a lot of fun for an actor, a lot of hard work, very challenging. But I feel like, wow, I'm really involved in something so incredibly theatrical, and we're birthing this brand new play, you know what I mean? So for me, it's I've never been involved in an experience where the creation, the act of creation is so present.
Obviously, Miles Davis, but it seems that in doing Armstrong as compared to Glazer, it would be a bit of more of a challenge only because we know him. We've
yes.
seen him on our television
yes.
screen or perhaps in performance.
Yes.
We know him. We know
yes.
the sound. We
but
know
you
the
don't
look.
Know this guy. This is what Armstrong was like off camera.
Right.
Yeah.
And I should warn your listeners, this is not a play for children.
Yeah.
This is a play with very tough language in it because Armstrong used it offstage.
When But for you, mm-hmm. I mean, is that in bringing that character to life that there is a bit of more of a challenge because we have an expectation?
Yeah, there is. But, you know, my interest in doing the play was to look at Armstrong's private side, and that's what Terry's play brought up when I first encountered it. Because I didn't know a lot about Armstrong. I will admit I was very ignorant to this man's prowess and celebrity and iconic stature and primarily his virtuosity as a jazz musician. Very ignorant to that. I knew a little bit about it, but not a lot. Not as much as I know now, of course. So for me, I'm not out there trying to imitate Armstrong. I'm trying to capture his essence. And once again, I'll go back to the words. The words of the play give me the situations and the stories and the dialogue to actually go about doing that. And then the hope is that the audience that's there sees that, feels that, and gets Armstrong. Because I couldn't imitate him. I don't think anybody could.
No.
So it's harder in the sense that there are expectations, but I hope those expectations are met vis-a-vis the work that's being shown in the play.
Terry, what was the decision early on in how to incorporate music into the play?
Well, I knew to begin with that I didn't want somebody pretending to play trumpet. It never looks right on a stage. Although John is handling a trumpet, and he's been coached by a professional trumpeter on how to clean one and disassemble it on stage. The great discovery that we made is that he can sing. So he does singing at two crucial moments in the play. And I'll just say, I think you'll all find it quite a pleasant surprise.
You talk about how you wanted to capture what this man was like off stage, and talk a little bit about what, because he had such charisma mm-hmm. on stage and almost cuddly.
Well, that's not phony, you know. Armstrong really was a very warm, fundamentally optimistic man. But he was a genius, and all geniuses are complex. So he was a genius who could also be very angry, who could hold a grudge, and who knew the score about life, who didn't have any illusions about race relations in America or really about anything else. And if you only know Armstrong from having heard the records, maybe seen him on television if you're older, seen his films, this other side of him, this tougher side, which is the other side of the coin. They're both sides of the same coin, the real man. But it's going to surprise you. It may actually startle you. I hope that it startles you.
In looking at what startles you, I mean, you talk about race. What was interesting is that the nation would accept him in many quarters where he would not be accepted.
Yes.
Or others would not be accepted in the same circumstance.
That's part of what the play tries to show. I mean, mm-hmm. as John knows well, I mean, Armstrong's manager, Joe Glazer, helped him to shape a public image that was not threatening to the white audiences of the 30s and 40s. And again, it was not phony. It wasn't artificial. Armstrong was what he seemed to be, but he was more than that. And part of what this play will show you is how Armstrong and Glazer worked together to cultivate that public image and what it meant and what it cost him, I think.
And at that, and I, you know, at least from my own, I did quite a bit of research on Armstrong and Glazer and obviously jazz music of that time from the 1910s all the way up to obviously 1970s and beyond. And many of the artists, like Armstrong, certainly he was of his own caliber, had someone like a Joe Glazer behind them, helping them shape their images, you know, for the white audiences that they were going to play for to make them somewhat non-threatening. So it wasn't just unique to Armstrong. It was kind of pretty much part of the music business. However, behind that, and I think that's what Terry's play is kind of getting at, is the man who made that choice to do that and create that was also a part of Armstrong. I mean, it wasn't something that was foreign to him. He had a great disposition. He loved humanity. He was very generous. So I think some of those things worked with him as a performer. But what's behind that is more interesting to me. That's a choice, and then you live with that choice, and then at some point, there's a consequence for that choice. And I think the play deals very nicely with Armstrong dealing with the consequences of what he created.
And here's a guy who was, as a child, abandoned pretty much by his by his parents.
His father walked out. His father walked out on the family the day he was born. His mother did raise him, but she was a prostitute, and they lived in Black Storyville. As he says in the play, "I come from Storyville, where the whores live." And you know, when you're living it, when you're in the middle of it, everything seems normal.
Right.
But in later life, he realized what an extraordinary journey he had made, and it was an uphill journey.
And the impact of I guess it can't be understated, because so much is made about the jazz culture, but of growing up in New Orleans at that time in that place of what that how that affected him and his artistry.
Sure enough, though, as Armstrong will explain to you in the play, jazz wasn't the only music he heard or that he loved or that went into the mix that became his style. You'll hear Armstrong actually talking about how grand opera shaped his style as well.
But he started very young.
Oh, he was just a little kid. He was singing on the streets in Storyville when he was 6-7 years old. Said he heard Buddy Bolden, which he may or may not have done, because he said he heard him when I think he was 7, John, something like that.
7, 8.
But he remembered everything he heard.
When did he first, when was the connection first made with Joe Glazer?
34, 30. Well, they worked together in 28 when they were in Chicago. But if I'm remembering correctly, Johnny became his manager in 1935.
34, 35.
Yeah.
And then was his manager for the rest of Armstrong's, well, obviously for the rest of his, Glazer's life. Glazer passed away before Armstrong.
Yeah, 40 years.
So they had a lifelong manager-client or manager-artist relationship, which is quite unique. And what I feel like what Armstrong had Glazer do for Armstrong and what Glazer had Armstrong do for Glazer worked out for both. I mean, they both made themselves millionaires with this unique partnership. And I'm sure musicians of the time may have not given so much responsibility to a manager or to an agent as Glazer had over Armstrong. So Armstrong was just left to really create his art. Whereas Glazer was really left to kind of run the books and book the gigs and get the musicians and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then here's a man, Armstrong, on the road 300 nights a year doing gigs, you know, one-nighters all over the place.
He was an iron man.
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
Mm. So does Glazer become a friend, more of a sibling,
I'm going to let John answer that.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, he's all of those, I think, and I think I would even stretch it as far as say a father figure to Armstrong, and I think we touch on that in the play, but their relationship was somewhat symbiotic. I mean, they both had skills that the other didn't, or they both required skills that the other didn't have, such that they could create a whole. So I look at, you know, he was his friend, he was a father figure, he was a peer. I mean, all these different things that you could think of in a relationship. I feel Glazer and Armstrong had, and there was love there too. You know, they loved one another. It wasn't just a purely business proposition. They loved one another.
But it's a very complicated love, one that crosses a racial line, one in which there's an element of dependency, one in which on Glazer's part, there are with the love is also condescension, unconscious racism.
Yeah.
You know, when John, and he changes just like on the flip of
a coin.
They
have to go in and out of each of those characters.
Suddenly he's a mobbed up white Jewish manager standing there on the stage. That's quite a sight. I'm telling you.
But there, it seems that Glazer ultimately also had, and I guess it'd probably be hard to parse out, but a respect for the music and the talent.
Well, that's a very interesting question.
It sure is.
Or versus, this I is think my he may have
had
cow.
More. Yeah, I think he may have had more respect for the talent than so the music, and but the way in which he shaped Armstrong, I don't think it doesn't seem to me Glazer was interested in jazz music.
These are questions we leave open.
We
in
leave
the play.
Open we, in the play.
We want the audience to go away, each member of it, drawing their own conclusion about what this relationship meant.
Yeah.
And what it added up to in the very end, just as Armstrong himself
is trying to
answer these
questions.
Trying
to work that out as well. And there's no, he doesn't, I'm not saying he comes to an answer as well, but it's, that's the real big question. Was everything that I did, was it worth it?
Yeah.
Was it the right thing to have done? Could I have done something different?
And that's the answer to the first question you asked us. Why do you set a play like this at the very end of a man's life, at maybe the last night that he's ever going to play? Because that's when you start asking yourself the big question.
That's when there's reflection and meditation on one's career and one's life. And he's also at a point in the play where, you know, he's 70 years old. Armstrong is at the moment that the play starts. And he knows his health is failing. And he's looking at some of his last days ahead. Henceforth, the reflection on one's life. So it actually works perfectly to begin to ask those questions at that time.
Is there a clear in the research? I know that because he had stated, you know, I was born on July 4th in 1900, and then it was actually later in 1901.
Yeah, August 2, 1901.
So was there in finding out fact, were you greatly concerned about getting all of that right?
Well, remember that this play started with a primary source biography.
Right.
And I think it would be fair to say that I busted my hump over getting everything right in that book. This play is a fictionalized version of part of the book.
But was that a challenge? I mean, was that information out there?
Fortunately, it was. Armstrong was a pack rat. He knew what he was. He knew it was Louis Armstrong. He kept everything. And he also made hundreds and hundreds of reels of private tape recordings. Yeah. I was the first biographer to draw on them. John has actually gotten to listen to some of these tapes. So my book is as accurate as it is possible for any biography to be at this moment in time.
Mm. What is... Is there still, do you think now that it has been so long since his death that there comes an enigmatic quality?
There are questions you can't answer ultimately about somebody, even somebody as open as Armstrong. But the real enigma in this play is Joe Glazer. Because this is, as I often like to joke with people, mob guys don't keep diaries.
Right.
And Glazer is someone whom I had to imagine more as a character than Armstrong. I talked to people who knew him. I read every existing interview with him. There's a 10-minute audio interview of him that survived. But ultimately, I was trying to see into somebody who preferred to remain closed.
Yeah. Fly pretty much
for good reason.
What was his association with Al Capone?
John, what's the speech say in the play? He ran the whorehouses and clubs on the south side.
The clubs, Al Capone's clubs on the south side and the whorehouses, too.
Yeah.
So it seemed as if they had quite a bit of an association.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't, you know, like one of the top lieutenants. He was one of the business guys, but he worked directly for Capone.
And he ran the Sunset Club, which is one of the clubs that... Armstrong played it.
Do you get a sense of was there any of other clients of Glazer's that had a vastly different experience?
It's hard to know. I mean, Armstrong was his first client as a manager, and subsequently, you're the one in the play. You tick off the list of his famous clients.
Yeah, well, there's B.B. King, Billie Holiday, Dinah Washington, Lionel Hampton. I think I say them almost in that order.
Yeah.
And Duke Ellington.
And Duke Ellington, yeah.
You know, different people. Nobody had that intimate and interdependent a relationship with Glazer.
Or as long, right?
Yeah.
No, yeah. He was the first client, and he was with Glazer until Glazer died.
Yeah. So those for those others, that relation, I mean, can you get anything from their stories, from their experiences?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, I'm in the middle of writing a biography of Duke Ellington. People dealt with Glazer differently depending on their own personalities. I mean, Armstrong's need as he says in the play, and he said this in life, was for somebody who would relieve him of all need to think about business, yeah. so that he could go out on the bandstand and as he says, play his gig. Yeah. And other people didn't necessarily want that.
And that was the responsibility that he gave to Glaser, which is a unique part of their relationship. Whereas Glaser handled all that stuff, so Louis Armstrong can get up on stage and play his gig, his music, focus on that.
Was Armstrong ever, play the boss card of, look, I'm the mail ticket?
Sometimes, yeah. But only in private.
I've read some letters where he, part of the research that I did was, going down to the Louis Armstrong house, and then there's a library attached with Queens College where there's tapes, pictures, video, even some of his trumpets, actually, and handkerchiefs.
And handkerchiefs, dirty handkerchiefs owned by Louis Armstrong.
Yeah. And just all sorts of memorabilia, but very important things, about his life. And I read some letters where he, in no uncertain terms, let Glaser know that, Glaser needs to do this, or perhaps it's going to jeopardize the relationship.
Yeah.
So there were those times that Armstrong really asserted himself in the relationship.
This is not a master-slave relationship. Yeah. Mm. The thing is that a lot of people looking at it from the outside concluded that was their perspective of it.
Because they didn't know it inside. So it was incredibly complex and subtle, and I think what the play really gets at is that subtlety and the complexity of that relationship and the private nature of it that now Armstrong is willing to talk about. So this is what I feel audiences or people who are big Armstrong fans don't know. And this is the private side, which Terry's play, which is what excited me initially when I read the play, because this was stuff I didn't know. Obviously, I didn't know a lot. But even as I began to know more and I learned about Armstrong and the music of the time, I still didn't know about this Glaser stuff. These were other things that started to, excavate as I did my research. And I said, this is fascinating.
Though this is not a play just for jazz people. I wrote it in such a way that all you have to know is there was this guy named Louis Armstrong who played trumpet. And the play itself contains all the information. I mean, it's a drama about two people, one of whom happened to be a famous genius. But the play's about the drama. It's not a history lesson.
So when you originally set out to write the biography, and at the end of that, of doing the research and finding out so much about this man's life, do you listen to the musically different? Do you listen to the music differently?
No, I really don't. I mean, because I've been
listening. Does it become a deeper experience?
The reason why I don't is because I first heard Louis Armstrong in 1965. He's been a part of my whole life. I was a jazz musician for many years. And the decision to write a book about him was, kind of the climax of a lifetime, and now a play, kind of a climax of a lifetime of involvement with him. So I don't hear it differently.
I certainly do. I mean, prior to the play, all I really knew about Armstrong, or at least having heard, was Hello, Dolly. Mm. So that was kind of my introduction. And I don't know how I felt about the song. It wasn't necessarily on my top 10, so it wasn't something I was listening to in any kind of frequency. But after going through his life and tracking the music at those various periods in his life, I have to say it changed my whole experience of listening to Armstrong music. All of it. And my relationship to the man has gone 360.
Sachmo at the Waldorf runs the Shakespeare and Company's Tina Packer Playhouse through September 16th. For ticket and showtime information, you can call the box office at 413-637-3353, 413-637-3353, or visit their website, which is the best URL in the world, shakespeare.org, shakespeare.org. John Douglas Thompson, Terry Teachout, I thank you very much for joining us this morning. Best of luck in your endeavors, and a great treat to have you with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.